Welcome to CineLit. Today, maybe, possibly, if the cinema gods are listening, we are looking at the film history of James Bond. I say maybe, possibly, as we've already recorded this podcast once before back in February 2020, just prior to the COVID pandemic that swept the globe and knocked films left, right and centre off their release dates. And Bond over the last year or so has been somewhat of a pinball, bouncing around from release date to release date. But it's now got a new release date, end of September in the UK. And fingers crossed, this podcast will be relevant when it hits screens next month. So here we are in August 2021, having another crack at the James Bond franchise and its impact on cinema. My name is Adam Marsh. I am joined by CineLit's resident expert, Daryl Buxton. How are you, Daryl?
Yeah, very good, Adam. Looking forward to talking all things Bond and talking about the whole franchise and spy movies in general. So should be good. And let's hope that the film does go ahead as planned this time.
Yeah, well, touch wood, touch all the wood around you that it will go ahead. And we are also joined by Bond mega fan and director Dominic Burns. How are you, Dom?
I'm good. I'm excited to be chatting all things Bond, for sure. Great to be talking to you boys again.
Yeah, because we first got together in 2019, February, and we went through a whole podcast recording Bond with you and Daryl, and here we are a year and a half on, doing it all again. So I hope you've remembered exactly what you said first time round.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, this time round, if you can hear in the background, I'm also being joined by a dog that I'm dog-sitting and won't stop barking. So I just apologise in advance that if you can hear a dog barking in the background throughout this interview.
So we are back here looking at the long history of Bond. It's a fairly mammoth task that we've set ourselves to try and gallop through the history of Bond. 50 plus years, 25 official canon movies. And but I figure we break it up, as most people do, in the different actor eras of Bond. So we'll look at Sean Connery, then we'll look at the one-off Bonds, George Lazenby, Barry Nelson in the TV series in the 50s, and we'll look at Roger Moore, and then Timothy Dalton, and then Pierce Brosnan, and to the current custodian of the role, Daniel Craig. So yeah, so should we start right way back at the beginning? Sean Connery, the original Bond, the guy who I guess set the tone for what the Bond films could be and would be. Not the first Bond on screen, as we mentioned briefly, but the first one that had international appeal, I believe. Yeah. So what are your thoughts on Sean Connery? It's usually people go, oh, the best Bond.
I mean, he came to the series really not as an unknown entirely, but as, and I think the Bond series has always done this with its casting. Whenever there's talk about a new Bond, the newspapers and the media and nowadays websites and social media and so on always start talking about the obvious names. I mean, the name that's been talked about all the time in recent years is Idris Elba, you know, and that it was even happening with people like Robbie Williams a few years ago, you know. But there's always these one or two big names that the papers latch onto, and the Broccoli's always managed to sort of open up a drawer and pull out somebody who you're not expecting. It was like that with Daniel Craig. It was like that with Timothy Dalton. It was like that with Roger Moore, and certainly like that with George Lazenby. I think Pierce Brosnan was perhaps the only one where he'd been sort of mentioned as a name, a possible in passing in the press. And this is a thing that goes right back to the start of the series, because Connery was not seen by everyone as a sort of ideal fit. I think in terms of his look and his style and everything, he was. But in terms of his acting experience, maybe not. And people were talking about Patrick McGoohan and other actors like that. So, yeah, the first thing to say about it is he was a little bit of a surprise, I think.
I think it's interesting because I think there's an argument for everyone who's played Bond in the movies. I think there's an argument for them being the best Bond. And I'm a nightmare for whichever Bond I'm currently watching. I'll start to convince myself that this is my favourite Bond of them all. I grew up really with the Roger Moore Bonds. So there's Roger Moore's always got a special place in my heart. But of course, Sean Connery just set the bar so high right from the start. I'm a huge, huge fan of those Connery Bonds. And especially if you look back, I mean, like the last Connery movie I watched, the last Connery Bond I watched was From Russia With Love. And if you look at the fight in the train, that fight scene is absolutely brutal. And the fight choreography would hold up to this day. Well, of course, they did a similar, I think they nodded to it in Spectre, the last Bond before No Time to Die. So Connery was definitely, you know, a genuinely tough guy. You know, he didn't mind mixing it up. And I think that really, really shows on screen. And he also had that effortless charm. Whereas, say, with Roger Moore, he had the charm and the fun, but you wouldn't necessarily believe that, you know, he would win a bar fight in the same way that Connery would, you know? And then if you take Timothy Dalton, and I know, sorry, Adam, you're trying to concentrate on the first one first, but for Timothy Dalton, he could definitely win a bar fight, in my opinion, but perhaps didn't have the same sort of effortless charm that Moore did. Although I think that Timothy Dalton is basically the blueprint for Bourne. And for me, he was an amazing Bond, very underrated. He was just ahead of his time. But we'll get to that. Sorry, I'm getting ahead of myself.
And that's the podcast, guys. Cheers. Thanks. we wrapped it up.
Yeah, I think what you can say about the, you know, if we're sort of covering these early films as a batch, and you're talking about them as the Connery years, but of course, you know, the producers would have seen them as the Cubby Broccoli years as well, because nobody knew at the time that it was going to go on for 50, 60 years. You know, it was a risk. Also, I think in terms of the directors that were appointed to the series, until recent years, they've always sort of gone the same way with directors, in that a lot of the people who are the big directors of Bond, and especially early on the early Connery films, were not people with a directorial background. They often used people who'd proven themselves really, really efficient on second unit direction, on big action movies, or editors they often picked as well. You know, it's people like Terence Young, John Glenn, Guy Hamilton, Peter Hunt, who only made one Bond film, but probably the best one, which we'll talk about later, was completely inexperienced and made his directorial debut on that, you know. And so there were always these sort of chance-taking elements. The one thing that I would say about the early films as well is I think what they do is, you could easily film these stories, and of course they're all based on Ian Fleming novels, which the films then massively expand. And this is the big thing with them, because you could film the Fleming novels, and they'd be great port little sort of film noir type things. You can imagine them in black and white, you know, 1950s movies or something, 40s, 50s movies, and that was the template really for the spy film. And there's an element of sort of film noir in there as well, I think, in these tales. And what these early films did is they took that idea, they took that sort of core idea, and instead of making a sort of 75-minute black and white, you know, very tight thriller, they set the same story on a massive, massive canvas and set this spy figure in the middle of this sort of exploding, expanding world. And I think that was something new to cinema, really. And to pitch Connery, fairly inexperienced, in the middle of all that, was really throwing an actor in at the deep end, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily entirely agree with that, Daryl. I think the books were definitely sold as globe-trotting adventures of a high-end spy having champagne with glamorous women, playing baccarat in the biggest casinos around the world, places that you poor reader in Preston, will never, ever get to go. But you can relive, though. You can live that life by reading these books. And that was definitely sold as a kind of travelogue kind of thing, but with a spy story as part of the appeal of those Bond books. Yeah. It was definitely selling of the glamour.
Yeah. What I'm getting at there is that the spy on film had always been, other than occasional movies by directors like Hitchcock, who could sort of expand that world in the way that Ian Fleming did, the spy traditionally had been a very sort of insular sort of figure on screen, and had featured mainly in sort of programmer type movies, you know, often B movies or so on. I think the Bond films were something new in that respect, in that they were still, and I don't know whether Ian Fleming does this necessarily, but I always get the impression from the movies, and especially from the casting of someone like Connery, that he's sort of finding his way into this world. You know, he's at home in it, but there is this element where he's sort of new to this and finding his way in a little bit, and that he's getting used to this sort of globe-trotting lifestyle.
Well, the whole thing is, it is interesting from that point of view, isn't it? Because the films, you know, obviously they are, you know, perfect escapism, and they never worry too much about how they get from A to B, and how this perfectly pressed tuxedo is suddenly in, you know, in God knows what location, you know, with Bond wherever he is. You never see him worrying about his travel. But I think, yeah, that element of it is important, but I can't speak to it from the books because I don't know. I've never read a Bond book, which I'm sort of, it's just suddenly occurring to me speaking. Really, it's quite bad. I should have at least read one, but I haven't actually. But just going back to a point that you made earlier, Daryl, which I thought was actually really interesting, is that I wonder if it was because of the Broccolis wanting to retain a certain degree of control over the franchise by bringing in these types of directors. Because it is, I mean, it's kind of more of a modern thing, really, for franchise. Well, in fact, if you think about it, the actual franchise itself is relatively modern, in that now every time a studio makes a movie, they're looking at it from a point of view of as a franchise.
And so films today are very much sort of, you know, films at this level are very much producers' films. Look at something like the Mission Impossible series, or look at even the superhero stuff, the Marvel and DC superhero films.
Well, yes,
they're sort
no,
of appointing
no.
directors in the same sort of way that the Broccolis did.
Yes and no, you see, because I think that's interesting, because look at the Broccolis using someone like a Sam Mendes, particularly when they brought in Sam Mendes. I mean, he had a very powerful voice. You know, Marvel even using someone like Kenneth Branagh, you know, the thinking, assumes the thinking being that, you know, okay, well, we know that, you know, the second unit are going to deal with the effects and the massive set pieces. So let's bring in a director that can really handle acting to handle the stuff that the first unit director is actually going to be hands-on doing. Hence, you know, someone like a Kenneth Branagh or a Taika Waititi, if I pronounce his name correctly. There does seem to be a trend more so these days than back when the Sean Connery Bonds were out, of bringing in an auteur, a director with a strong, specific voice who can stand up to producers' opinions. But, and I know this is going off subject slightly, then you look at something like the Star Wars, recent Star Wars, if you concentrate on the main canon trilogy, where they did JJ, then they brought in, Looper director, Ryan Johnson, and JJ again. You see, that's a good example of where some studio over, you know, you kind of need a studio to oversee that, because I'm not talking about whether you liked or hated those movies. They were so wildly different and clearly not following, you know, a larger story arc. They were just kind of going off, and each director was bringing, JJ and Ryan were both bringing their unique vision and unique voice to it. And unfortunately, I think that took away from the trilogy as a whole. Whereas those early Bond movies, if you know, the one thing that you can say is relatively consistent is that the tone, you know, this almost sounds derogatory, and I really don't mean it that way, but you kind of knew what you were getting into from, I guess, you know, once you established the first two or three from, say, Goldfinger onwards, you kind of had a good idea of what you were going to get when you were going in. And that's exactly what the audience wanted, which proved which has been proven time and time again by the consistent box office performance.
Does that make the films a little bit interchangeable? Are they difficult to sort of distinguish from one another? You know, do people remember individual scenes, but then sort of wonder, you know, oh, I can't remember what movie that was in. You know, I remember that bit, but
that depends on what level of fan you are, I guess. I mean, in terms of if you're a casual fan, if you like, who just goes and sees the Bond movie every 2-3 years, or however often it came out. I think it came out annually at one point. And you just go and enjoy it, and it doesn't really matter to you. You know, as you say, it kind of, you know, a couple of years' time, you're not going to remember a scene from Goldfinger or a scene from Thunderball. But if you're like me and you watch them, you know, over and over again, I can. You know, they are. The, yeah. Each film does have a distinguishable voice to a point.
Well, yeah. This is a franchise that does have its sort of obsessive fans as well, who I'm sure can distinguish one film from another. Adam, you've sort of set this recording up as you're trying to sort of get us to talk about the Bonds in little groups like this, and of course. The immediate flaw there is with Sean Connery in that he made, what, the first five movies, yeah. Then missed one, then made another one, and then came back and did an unofficial one in the 80s. So
yeah.
It's not as though you can sort of talk about the actors in a chronology like that, because Connery's the guy who sort of messes all that up.
Yeah, you can. Because Diamonds Are Forever and Never Say Never are rubbish. So you can finally, you can say that, can't you? He came back, did a rubbish one, went away and then did a non-official one. And that was rubbish as well.
Did a sort of a dodgy remake of Thunderball.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, well, that's the by the way, Diamonds Are Forever is not rubbish. So you can take that right back. But no, it was all. I was reading about this relatively recently, and it was all to do with the reason they were able to make Never Say Never Again is it's basically a Thunderball remake.
Yeah.
And what's interesting about Never Say Never Again is it doesn't have certain characters in it. Doesn't have the opening, the classic opening of it down the gun barrel. Doesn't have obviously the bomb music. I don't think it has Q in it. I can't remember. And because obviously they're not anything that they couldn't derive specifically from Thunderball, they couldn't use. So it's a very, very strange, because apparently that was that rose its head again in the last few years as well. Somebody else was trying to do a rival Bond. I heard about at some point. I can't remember when it was.
Well, they were trying to do a third version of Thunderball at one point. Yeah. But then I think Sony at the time, I think it was, who owned the Bond rights, just came in and went, no, we'll buy it. And they just bought it. So it's finally, they bought it out.
Okay, so Thunderball's finally in the stable with all the rest then. Was it Kevin McClory, I think it was, who had the rights to it, and the Broccoli's the rights, did.
They established a screenplay. Ian Fleming wrote the screenplay based on his book, but a lot of the elements in the screenplay were not in the book. So the other writer was like, well, I established those, I established Spectre, I established all these things. And for the most recent movie, Spectre, they ironed that out and got it through so they could use Spectre and they could use Blofeld again. Because they didn't use Blofeld all through the 70s, apart from one scene where they never mentioned him as Blofeld. They just had the image of him in Fear Eyes Only, maybe, or something like that, when they dropped him down a chimney at the start of the movie.
Yeah, that's Fear Eyes Only, yeah. Off the chopper, yeah.
So they kind of wrapped that up there. But then obviously they brought Blofeld back and they brought Spectre back with the last Daniel Craig movie. And that was when they sorted the rights out with Never Say Never Again.
Oh, is that what it was? I didn't know that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, initially, I mean, obviously, the Sean Connery years, he did five movies, and You Only Live Twice being the last one. That's the one in Japan where they make him up to look like a Japanese man. It's like, what? He's really dodgy. You know?
As Dom said, though, you know, do remember that these, other than You Only Live Twice, which came out a little later, the first four were annual, which is extraordinary.
Yeah. And so I think he was fed up of doing them. And I think that kind of shows in that last one. It's got a great Blofeld with Donald Pleasance, but it does feel like it's the end and they need something fresh. And obviously they went into You Only Live Twice, Honor Majesty's Secret Service with a new Bond. And
this is a very underrated Bond. I love Honor Majesty's Secret Service. And I think
my favorite.
I think it's one of those ones where it's like, it's massively underrated, but when you speak to a Bond fan, it's their favourite Bond.
A great Bond.
It's one of those things where it's just like, yeah, it's good. It's really good. I mean, he's not massively great. I don't think he's all right. He's not bad. He's no worse than, say, Timothy Dalton in Living Daylights or Roger Moore in Live and Let Die.
You know, I love Dalton in both the Bonds. So let's not go there.
Yeah. No. It wasn't a criticism. First movie where you're finding your feet as Bond and you're establishing yourself. Yeah. He's no worse than Roger Moore was, than Pierce Brosnan was. I mean, if anything, Pierce Brosnan nailed it first time out, didn't it? With
yeah,
GoldenEye.
He did. Yeah, well, so, I mean, yeah. GoldenEye was by far his best Bond, in my opinion. But going back to, I mean, if you think about what Lazenby had to do, I mean, like Connery had, as we discussed before, Connery had set the bar so high, and Connery was just so, I mean, you know, if you're going to have a conversation about the most charismatic actors to ever walk on screen, then you have to include Connery in that conversation. You just have to. And Lazenby came along and had to kind of, in a way, Lazenby bridged the gap between Connery and Moore, because it was less jarring when we got to Moore. Because, I mean, I say like I was alive at the time, but, you know, looking back on it, this is how I presume it played out. Because I would argue that if Moore had taken over straight away after Connery, people would have been a lot less accepting of him. Mm. But it was kind of Lazenby almost had to sort of bridge that gap of getting people used to a Bond that wasn't Connery. And it's interesting, because if I remember rightly, in that, in fact, I'm sure, in On Her Majesty's Secret Service, it directly references, he picks up props and stuff, doesn't he, from Dr. No and from previous movies. So it makes it very clear that they're trying to be a very direct sequel. Whereas Live and Let Die, Roger Moore's first film, that to me doesn't, it's not trying to be, it's kind of its own entity in a sense. It's not trying in the same way to be a, I mean, I know it is a sequel, but it's not like, you know, On Her Majesty's Secret Service was very, very purposefully trying to be a sequel, trying to continue on the same character in the same story. Whereas Live and Let Die felt like a bit of a new beginning, as I think they've done with all Bonds since on the new Bond's first film.
I think with Live and Let Die, it was like, here's another adventure starring James Bond.
Yeah.
Whereas with On Her Majesty's Secret Service, it was like, why does Bond look differently? Has he had plastic surgery? Because now we just accept the role as, you know, it's a new actor playing the role. Whereas in 1967...
Don't ask any sort of awkward questions, you know, about why has this guy got a new face, you know?
Exactly.
And I think audiences go with that, you know. We have it with other characters too. I mean, Doctor Who is sort of famous
But Doctor Who, they and other things like that, they create a mechanic.
It's written into the storyline.
Exactly. Yeah. Doctor Who regenerates and becomes a new person. Yeah. You know, sometimes they have other, I mean, one of my favourite of these kind of regeneration ones is the TV show Due South, where they introduce a new character and he's walking around for the first couple of episodes talking about how he's that character and everyone's saying he's that character. And the Mountie character's like, but he's not that character. He doesn't look anything like that character. And he goes on a few episodes, and it turns out the other guy's undercover and he's taking his place there. Yeah. So it makes it look like he's still there. And it was just like, so they create a money, but they didn't do that in Bond. They just said, okay, it's the same guy. It's the same guy.
On a side question, is there, I'm just trying to think off the top of my head, is there another major movie franchise where the lead main character, I know they've done it in a few comic book movies, but I suppose Batman would be an obvious one. Just trying to think of major franchises that keep the same character but change the actor.
I guess whether they keep the same character in the same timeline.
Yeah.
I mean, because Bond, the Roger Moore Bond and the Timothy Dalton Bond are supposed to be part of the same lineage as the other ones. You know, the Timothy Dalton's Bond character was the same character that went on the adventure in Goldfinger, you know, and did the rocket packs and things like that, all those kind of things in Moonraker. He was, you know, he was the same. It's the same character. Whereas the Batmans, I guess, they wipe the clean and it's a fresh start.
What happens nowadays is we get so many reboots, and they're so the reboots happen within a very short space of time as well. Look at what happened with Hulk, for instance. You know, and so audiences, I think, have got used to that now. I think modern audiences are very, very used to, oh, that guy is now playing Spider-Man, or that guy is playing Batman. And you just sort of accept it in the way that I think audiences over the past 60 years have accepted it with Bond. And it's remarkable that they did, you know, it really is. I mean, in the Lazenby one, there is that gag, of course, about this wouldn't happen to the other guy. But then I think Roger Moore comes in and just makes the part his own. And I think ever since then, audiences like those films, and they were popular, and it didn't do more any harm that they started with Live and Let Die, which I think was very, very appealing to audiences at the time, and a really great, slick sort of winner of a movie, you know. And I think audiences liked watching that film, and therefore they liked Roger Moore. And I think ever since then, everyone's been accepting of it in Bond in a way that they might not have been if other series had tried it. But now, as I say, with reboots in big budget movies, I think audiences are sort of conditioned to it nowadays.
They do keep other actors the same as well, don't they? You know, M, Q,
Judy
Dench in the Pierce
Brosnan. So you get your continuity in a way. There is
that element of it. There's no real. I'm just sorry. There's not a hard and fast rule to it, is there? Or is there? I don't know. Maybe I'm.
No.
This is what I was going to say is that this is where you then enter the world of fan fiction. I think I'm sure you can go on websites and so on where people are trying to sort of make sense of all of this and piece it all together. And it's so convoluted that you can't. But I bet there are people out there that are trying.
Yeah, you can't because, some of the actors play different characters. I mean, the M from the early 80s Bonds was a different character in The Spy Who Loved Me.
Yeah.
It was a different ministry character, and he suddenly is M. And it's like, well, okay.
I mean, even the new film has got a 008, hasn't it? So, that again is throwing a sort of Bond successor into the mix.
But wasn't Sean Bean 008 in GoldenEye, or was he 006? He was 00 something, Sean Bean was.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was a 00, yeah. With the numbering of the agents, I don't know how this is sort of covered through the books and the films, but sometimes you get the impression that a new number's allocated when an agent dies, and sometimes you get the impression there's a certain number of agents out there. And it's never really been made clear. I don't know how right I am on that.
Well, did you guys, and I won't say the spoiler because I don't know whether we should or not, but did you guys read about the huge spoiler that came out for A Time, No Time to Die, about what they're doing with that?
Yeah.
I won't say anything, but
I haven't.
Don't worry, people listening. I absolutely won't say this. And I was really, really gutted to read it. And if, by the way, you haven't heard about this spoiler, whatever you do, don't try and track it down because it's going to be a huge moment and an awesome moment in the film. But I think the spoiler I'm referring to brings some clarity to what you were just saying, Daryl. I think it's quite interesting.
Right. Well, that will be interesting for me. It sounds like I'll enjoy that aspect of the film.
I think there's a world where they create what their rules as they go along. And I think the idea of multiple 00 agents didn't really start landing until the early 80s when you had, I think it was 006 was killed at the start of Octopussy. He's in the clown makeup and gets killed, and there's a revenge. And I think in the Timothy Dalton movies as well, there's
didn't they do it in Live and Let Die though? The opening of Live and Let Die, wasn't that a bunch of 00 agents that were taken out at the start of Live and Let Die? I think they did. I can't remember.
Yeah, I don't know. I can't remember. But I mean, we're not going to go. Let's stop down there next. We're going into the world of fan fiction and crazy craziness. We don't want to go down there now. We've touched Sean Connery. We've got the translation to George Lazenby, arguably one of the better movies in the series.
I just think it's the perfect Bond film.
And it certainly has something that not many of the other Bond films have, and that's like a real personal connection for Bond in that movie, where you know a tragedy happens in his life. Most of the movies are like cookie cutter advent. This is another James Bond adventure, and by the end of the adventure, everything is back to normal. Whereas this one isn't, and it doesn't happen very often. But you do get references to what the events of that movie happening in later movies. We've talked about the opening of For Your Eyes Only. He's there at the start, visiting his wife's grave. So you do get some of those hangovers, and not very often, but you do get them as it goes along.
The Connery years have got a lot of criticism for Bond being a sort of womanizing character. Now that continues with George Lazenby, but of course part of his character arc is that changes, and he does actually meet, you know, the woman of his dreams and is planning to settle down, you know, and that adds a different layer of drama to this one, and which really works, I think.
It is interesting that sort of looking back on these movies. I think if we'd recorded this 3 or 4 years ago, I think the Sean Connery movies, they feel way more dated now than they did 5 years ago. So, you know, just because the world's changed so much and with regards to those sensibilities, looking back at old movies.
And that at the if you go back 20 years to the time when Austin Powers was ruling the box office, those Connery films look current almost, you know.
Yeah.
But that's one of the more fascinating elements that I hope that they don't shy away from in the new Bond. I hope they study the fact that he's a bit of a dinosaur, well, a lot of a dinosaur, and the methods he would typically use and the way he would typically live his life is just not the way that you can operate in the modern world.
There's a drama in doing that and layers to the character, I think, if you do
very
that.
Much. So.
And I'd agree with you there, Dom.
Well, I think they've done that from Casino Royale, and I don't think there's...
True, yeah, they've touched on it. Sure.
Yeah, I think there's definitely been, particularly the dynamic between Daniel Craig's Bond and Judi Dench's M. There's definitely tension there in those aspects.
That's one of the many reasons that, again, skipping ahead, but that's one of the main reasons I adore Skyfall so much, because that was just, apart from it just being an absolute belting movie that I loved, and I know it does split opinion, but I loved it. When was the last time that, I think Judi Dench was in her late 70s when that movie came out, and a woman in her late 70s stealing the biggest action film of the year is not something I can remember previously. And she just stole that movie. She was so badass in that film. I love Judi Dench.
But it is, again, similar to, the reason why I think Skyfall is so successful is the same reason why I think Honor Majesty's Secret Service is so successful. They built up genuine character development between the two
Absolutely.
Characters
Massive.
And they made it so it was like, this isn't just another person that I've got to rescue. This is M, this is Judi Dench's M. There's a connection there.
100%. I couldn't agree with you more. For me, the key with something like a Bond movie, where no matter what you do, subconsciously you're aware that the chances of Bond dying, it's just not going to happen. It's just, there's something in the back of your mind that tells you that always. So the best thing you can do with these types of films is you can put characters that you genuinely care about in jeopardy. And Judi Dench had built up such a rapport with audiences, and everyone had grown so fond of her, in my opinion at least, that when you put her in genuine jeopardy in Skyfall, and you really do, when Bond's sprinting up that street in London to try and, and he knows there's an assassination attempt about to take place, I genuinely believe that she was going to, that was the point that, she was going to get taken out. Again, we're in spoilerish territory. And, you felt like I was so emotionally invested in that scene. I really, really was. And I couldn't agree with you more, Adam. I totally agree that, if you, because they can do it, that Bond character, it's got enough depth. There's enough meat on the bone there to really draw out an emotive reaction from an audience. And when they do that and combine it with the action, that's when you do get the films that really do stand out above and beyond just the pure raw escapism, which, don't get me wrong, I adore and love, but that's when you get the films that stand out above the rest, in my opinion, and you get that balance right.
How much of this could be put down to outside influence? Because as we've said, the Bond films started out as annual and then were coming out regularly every 2 years, but then there've been occasional periods where they've sort of gone off the map for 4, 5, 6 years. And in those periods, we've seen other people come in, like Mission Impossible and the Bournes and so on, have come in and tried to steal some of the Bond thunder. And I'd argue that when Bond does eventually come back after a period of a few years, they do sort of learn these dramatic techniques and these sort of emotional sort of ideas and character ideas from the competition.
Well, I think that's a fascinating point, from an overall point of view, because I think that Bond is very reflective of pop culture. And if you watch through, as we were saying about what's accepted and what's not accepted in film generally these days, and I think Bond is tends to be very reactive of what's going on.
I agree.
And I think that it's no coincidence that the sort of biggest drought of Bond movies we had was when the Cold War ceased to be a thing. And it was almost like the sort of the tension and the point of Bond kind of lost its relevance a little bit. And then, of course, we had Golden. That was the end of the License to Kill, the last Timothy Dalton era. I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think the longest time between Bonds since they first came out was License to Kill to GoldenEye. I think that was the longest gap.
That's right. And of course, with this delay that we've now beaten that. So, but that's you know, coronavirus is the ultimate Bond villain, I guess. But
yes, and I would say, just to finish your point, Darren, I would also agree that I would say generally Bond has set the trend, but I think ever so occasionally it's fallen behind. And I think certainly when the Bourne movies came out, it did feel like where Bond should have gone. You know, to me, it felt like what Bourne did, particularly the first couple of movies, what Bourne did really did feel like that Bond had fallen behind and Bourne was kind of sort of treading the territory that Bond normally would do. But then I think Casino Royale kind of readdressed that balance, actually, and brought it back around. And, you know, they delivered a cracking film. But you can't argue, in my opinion, even right down to the way it was shot, that Casino Royale isn't influenced by Bourne, whereas typically it would be the other way around. You know, other thrillers would be influenced by Bond as opposed to Bond being influenced by the current popular thrillers, you know?
Yeah. I think it comes to the sort of like tail end of Bonds. You can see where the ideas are old. And it's usually the end of a particular actor's cycle. It's usually the end of the Roger Moore ones. It's the end of the Pierce Brosnan ones. I mean, 2002, Bourne Identity comes out. 2002, Die Another Day comes out, and it's like night and day, isn't it, watching those two movies?
It really is.
The great thing is that cinema always fills these Bond gaps, though, because as we've said, you get the Bournes and things, and then Bond, you know, funnily enough, Bond suddenly re-emerges. And even in that big gap from the late 80s through to the mid-90s, six-year gap, we had no Bond, but we had people like Chow Yun-fat as sort of suave, tuxedo wearing heroes with guns, you know. And there's always, it seems, even in times when we haven't got a Bond, we've always got something that sort of fills in, even if it happens to be Austin Powers. You know, there's always something that comes in, and it's almost as though we've got to have this particular type of hero in cinema. It's great when it is Bond, but it's quite interesting when it isn't, and when we've got these gaps to see what sort of comes in and sort of fills in. What you were saying about the Bond series being very reactive, Dom, I've actually written that exact word down in my notes in preparation for today. And I think this applies largely to the Roger Moore years, which we've sort of talked about.
Moonraker and Star Wars, anyone?
I'd go back even further. I'd say
Live and Let Die and Blaxploitation
is basically it's Blaxploitation, and of course you've got The Exorcist, which hasn't come out yet, but everyone knows it's on the way, and so They're sort of throwing in these sort of supernatural elements into it as well. But it's like the ultimate blaxploitation movie, even to the point where the Baron Samedi character was used in a blaxploitation horror film, Sugar Hill, the following year, you know. And of course, you know, again, that's one of these rights things where, because it's a figure from sort of folklore, the Bond people couldn't sort of say that they got the rights. So anyone could come in and use that character, and they did. But yeah, then you get onto The Spy Who Loved Me, and then you get onto to Star Wars comes out, and how does Bond react? You know, Moonraker.
The Roger Moore era is so fact. That's the era that you know that I grew up watching, really. And I delved into the Connery era from off the back of Roger Moore, from asking my mum and my gran and my dad about, you know, to tell me about the history of Bond and learning all about this character. And it was the first film character I was obsessed with. But I think the more, I mean, Live and Let Die, I love that movie. I think it's cracking. And it was recently I watched, because I read somewhere that Chris Nolan said that Spy Who Loved Me was a big influence on Tenet. And so I went back and gave Spy Who Loved Me another watch, which is any excuse to rewatch a Bond. And actually, The Spy Who Loved Me stands out for me in that series. It's a cracking thriller, The Spy Who Loved Me. It's absolutely brilliant. But it really does, for me, stand out as I've got to choose my words carefully, the sort of the most grounded of the more Bonds, I would argue, the Spy Who Loved Me. I mean, there's a couple of fun moments. Obviously, Jaws is in it, and you know, there's some fun. But if you look at things like Man with the Golden Gun, Moonraker, even View to a Kill, if you compare those to The Spy Who Loved Me, I mean, they're very, very different films. I mean, perhaps slightly less so For Your Eyes Only. That's perhaps a little more serious.
I think Spy Who Loved Me's got its own style of set. I mean, shootouts at the pyramids. It's quite globetrotty and expensive. Oh, no, that massive tanker set they set for the end sequences.
Absolutely, it's not. I don't think it's a smaller film. I think it's a huge film. I love it. I absolutely adore The Spy Who Loved Me. But I just think in terms of tone is what. Sorry if I wasn't.
Are you saying it's sort of more believable, more sort of real world, Dom?
Yes, I guess I guess it's a bit more serious. And I'm not necessarily saying, you know, there's anything wrong with not being serious. I mean, I love The Man with the Golden Gun. I love, you know, it's great fun. I love Moonraker. I love it. But the you know, Spy Who Loved Me is a thriller that would hold up in any era as a cracking, you know, you mentioned earlier about Hitchcock never making a Bond. He made North by Northwest, you know, to kind of get that Bond out of his system, in my opinion. You know, I'd say The Spy Who Loved Me lives up there with Goldfinger, lives up there with, you know, with this, the more serious Bonds that stand out.
I have a theory on the Bond films. I think the more successful ones, the ones that have got better music. I think it just goes hand in hand with the more memorable the song.
Are we getting into best Bond theme here now, Adam?
Not so much best Bond themes, but just because that's an endless argument, isn't it? But you do tend to have those ones where I can't remember the theme from that film.
Yeah.
The Spy Who Loved Me?
No. Just generally. If you can't remember it, it's probably not a great movie either. Because I just think they tend to go hand in hand, you know, like Spy Who Loved Me, Nobody Does It Better. What a great, you know, great Bond theme, you know, Live and Let Die.
Die Another Day, case in point.
Yeah.
So, I don't know what you mean now.
Yeah. So it's like, it's just, I mean, Octopus, I can't even remember the theme tune from that. There you go. You know. Yeah, so you know, there's a handful where you just think, done nothing.
Yeah. I want to pick up on a point that Dom raised earlier, where you were talking about how the end of the Cold War brought about the end of the Bond series with the two Dalton ones. But to jump ahead from that, just on this particular point, in the Brosnan years, since suddenly, you know, we hadn't got Cold War villains, it's interesting to see how the series reacted to that. I mean, we even get a sort of faux Rupert Murdoch as the villain in one of the films. So yeah, it must have been very interesting for the producers and for the script writers to think, well, who's the bad guy in these? What do we do now? We can't have the sort of big bad, you know, Russian bear or whatever, or the mad scientist with his laser experiments, or someone with his hollowed out volcano. What do we do? You know, and it's quite interesting, I think, in those 90s films, how they sort of respond to that.
Yeah, not well, really. I mean, I think the you know, it's another weather.
Well, it's not a surprise because the Bond villain is so set in stone that, yeah, it must have been a struggle to suddenly have that whipped away from you. And what do we do?
They try and create the North Korea as the as the big bad, don't they? Think it, but
yeah,
it just smacks of xenophobia in some ways when they start doing it like that. Back when it was the Russian thing, it was like it was us and them kind of mentality. It's not as much of that anymore.
You can be as offensive as you like about Russia, but you can't about certain other countries. You know, it's weird, but yeah, it was very much like that.
But I think it's a really interesting point, you know, because it was tough. Because Brosnan's a great Bond, you know. He's kind of, you know, he's got the sort of charm. He's got a tough edge to him, but he's still got the charm of Moore, and he does definitely bring his own interpretation of the character. I didn't feel like he was trying to sort of copy anyone else. He was just doing his thing, and I think he's a great, really great Bond. But yeah, I mean, Robert Carlyle was a pretty decent villain, but I just didn't think that they delivered on the promise of that character as well as they could have done. I agree. They definitely had a hard time sort of finding that Blofeld equivalent, for want of a better way of putting it.
Yeah, I think, I mean, you mentioned Robert Carlyle there, and we got people like Jonathan Pryce as well working in
the
series.
I thought Pryce was a pretty... I thought actually that was an interesting villain. I quite liked
him. Yeah, they're okay, but I think what you're missing with actors like that is a sense of grandeur. I think a good Bond villain needs to be huge, needs to be Dr. Evil, you know. And I think the ones in the 90s, they were contemporary, which was good, but an interesting response to the fact that they couldn't, there was no Cold War anymore. But, and this is one thing the series seems to be starting to get right again now, is looking at casting big iconic names in the villain roles, and people that have been big box office or award-winning successes in recent years. I mean, they're going for the Oscar winners now, I think. And I wish they'd done a bit more of that in the 90s rather than casting the sort of British
talent. That was a tricky one, because like Jonathan Pryce, Robert Carlyle, they are the Javier Bardems and Christoph Waltzes of the 90s, you know.
I think it's a lot less nowadays. It's a lot less. You got to remember, it's only really a relatively modern thing that it was almost seen in a weird way as selling out, I think, appearing in a franchise or doing something like that. Whereas now, yeah. I really don't think that's the case. You know, you could get Al Pacino as a Bond villain. You could get, you know, you could get De Niro in a Marvel movie. You could get
actors like that love it as an acting choice, don't they? They think, well, this part will stretch me. It's something different.
But in the 90s, it wasn't so much the case, right? I mean, it wasn't so much the case that you could... I mean, if you look at the... going back to Dalton, who I think is the most underrated Bond of all the Bonds. And as I mentioned at the start, I think he was ahead of his time. You know, he was very much a born Bond. And in a way, if you'd have got the Pierce Brosnan Bonds when you got the Dalton Bonds, and you got the Dalton Bonds when you got the Pierce Brosnan Bonds, you know, in terms of the tone... You perhaps would have found that the Bond franchise would have been still leading the way in terms of the way that the Bourne, because those two Dalton Bonds are very comparable to Bourne, I think. And I think that, I know actually, I heard, I can't remember whether I heard it or read it recently, but so apparently the Broccolis loved Dalton and were desperate to do another Bond with him, and in fact had a third script written. And they actually felt quite bad because License to Kill was, relatively speaking, action light, certainly comparable to other Bonds. And so they'd written this third Bond for Dalton, which was very, very action heavy. I can remember bits of the script, but not enough to fairly, you know, to say here because I might get parts wrong. But the script sounded incredible. And they really, really, really pushed to get it going. But the studio at the time, as I understand it, just wouldn't have it. And so they were eventually forced to let Dalton go. And because of their relationship with Dalton, they were so close with him. Apparently they said, look, we want you to say, you know, we want you to quit. We want you to say you haven't got the time or you don't want to carry on. Because, we just to give him that courtesy. So it looked like he was walking away as opposed to they were letting him go, which is obviously very different to how the Brosnan thing played out. And that's why we didn't get that third Dalton Bond. And I just wonder whether... the reason those Pierce Brosnan Bonds kind of went more into your sort of 80s Roger Moore territory was as a kind of a reaction to the more serious Dalton Bonds. And by doing that and by kind of going in a little bit more of a, I don't want to use the word daft, that's not fair, but in a little bit more of a playful direction with the Brosnan Bonds, what they actually did was put themselves out of step with the way that, you know, with the direction the franchise perhaps should have gone. And then they kind of they sorted that out with the when Daniel Craig came along with Casino Royale. But that doesn't necessarily mean Brosnan wasn't a brilliant Bond. He was a brilliant Bond. I just think that, as you pointed out before, Darren, I totally agree. Those Bonds were kind of in a weird hiatus. They didn't really know whether to go daft in the 80s, serious, you know, try and go more serious. You know, they didn't really know where they lived. But that's what it seems from the outside in anyway.
I think trying to compare the Bond film, I think the Bond franchise is reactive, but it's reactive to other films rather than the previous Bond films. I don't necessarily think they looked at Pierce Brosnan and said, okay, we need a lighter Bond after the dark Bond of Dalton. I think it was more a case of, well, what's popular at the moment in 1996? And you've got Will Smith cutting a cutting like a wisecracking figures. You've got a Mission Impossible. The first Mission Impossible movie was, what, 96, 97, 95?
But that was quite a serious movie, that first Mission
It was a serious movie, totally. As was GoldenEye.
Yes, I would argue the first Mission Impossible is perhaps slightly more serious in tone than the first GoldenEye.
Oh, no, it is. No, it absolutely is. But then it's not Bond, is it? It doesn't have the history of wisecracking Bond. You've got to have some wisecracking in a Bond movie. You've got to have some flirtatiousness and cheekiness about a Bond. Otherwise, it's not a Bond movie. You're making a Mission Impossible movie.
It is interesting, though, isn't it, in terms of... because a lot of people felt that Skyfall wasn't playful enough and had sort of too much of a serious tone. And then they made Spectre, which I felt didn't quite get that balance. It kind of tried to add playfulness to a serious tone Bond, if you like. And I didn't mind Spectre, but I didn't. I felt it. It felt a bit incongruous within itself, or like a bit juxtaposed. You know what I mean? It just didn't quite mesh together correctly.
Well, I think it's one of those things where we've been talking about the Bond films, like they're all one timeline. But with Casino Royale, it was marketed as a reboot in many ways. Yeah. Where
and then they even did a direct sequel to it.
Exactly.
As well,
yeah,
which was a first. So we sort of fostered that idea that we're telling one character's story here across these four or five films.
I like the way the Quantum of Solace started. That was great.
So they got to that stage where they've rebooted the character and they've done the serious coming of him becoming Bond, becoming the 007 character, getting his first license to kill and all that kind of stuff. And then the idea being that Spectre's where he becomes the James Bond character that Roger Moore is and Roger Sean Connery was in the later ones. So I guess that's where they're going. But I think some of that's kind of gone out of the window a little bit with it. It's kind of like, well, yeah, they're all part of the same universe now kind of thing.
Yeah, that's it. I think for audience familiarity and to try and make sure that they're staying at a level of popularity, they've introduced these familiar elements like we've got Blofeld back and things like that, and they're going a little bit more along the lines of trying to sort of reestablish the classic type of supervillain that you had in the Connery films. As you say, Dom, it doesn't quite mesh with the gritty, serious approach and the sort of character, the overriding character arc that Adam's talking about. The two things don't quite fit together there. I don't think you can sort of introduce all of these elements, lump them all together and expect to have anything coherent. And I think that the last Daniel Craig Bond did suffer from that. I'm hoping that they sort of iron that out in this new one. For God's sake, they've had plenty of time to.
I think they will. I've got high hopes. I must admit. I think Casino Royale and Skyfall really stand out for me as two corking bombs. Yeah. You know, in the whole franchise, they stand out and hold up. And I've got high hopes. I really do.
Let's just remind everyone at this point about the time that Daniel Craig, again, a surprise appointment to the role, as they often are. You know. But this one in particular got the online petitions, the outcry in the media. You know, how nonsensical does that seem? Doesn't it?
It's so interesting because, like, with the other surprise, like, oh my God, Roger Moore. It's like, yeah, Roger Moore had years doing Simon Templar, which was not quite the same, but not far off from his depiction.
Yeah.
Pierce Brosnan, who'd done the Remington Steele stuff. So they all had. Yeah.
So they were fits.
They were fits. Whereas Daniel Craig, Our Friends in the North, you know, he'd done like British dramas.
Layer Cake, didn't he?
He did Layer Cake. Very.
That seemed to be the one film that sort of got the producers interested.
Yeah. So just let me ask you this. In the book, is Bond English?
Yeah.
I mean, so straight away, I mean, so there is no... Because, I mean, Connery was Scottish for a start. So, yeah. I mean, like...
He's British super agent. He's a British secret agent.
But my point is that, you know, I just think people are going mad because Daniel Craig's Bond or because... It's like, what you know, are you going mad because he's different to the book? Are you going mad because he's different to Connery?
They were going mad because he's got a face like a bag of spanners. That's why they were going mad. He wasn't sexy
I think a lot of people were going mad because he had because of the blonde hair. And I think most women would argue when he was walking out the sea in his in his trunks in Casino Royale, that the sexiness was ticked, that box was ticked thoroughly. Because I tell you, as shocking as this sounds, boys, I don't look like that when I walk out to sea in my trunks. Yeah. And they're not asking me to be Bond, I'll tell you that for free.
Wasn't that a lovely, I mean, we talked a bit earlier about sexism in the Bond films. Wasn't that a lovely rejoinder across the decades to Dr. No? You know, what a fantastic sort of idea.
I think it was a great idea, a really, really good idea. And I think that the vitriol that the new Bond always attracts, I think it's just generally ridiculous, to be honest with you. And I mean, I would love to see Idris Elba be the next Bond. I mean, perhaps the argument being that perhaps he's getting a little bit older to take on a decade of. I do like it when a Bond sticks for a few movies and we can have a nice journey. So maybe he's. I don't need to be ageist. Maybe I'm not sure even sure how old Idris Elba is, but I would love him to see a real curveball. I somebody completely different and fresh. And yep. I certainly would love to see a person of colour take on Bond next. Definitely. I think that's the way the yep. franchise should go, in my opinion. I think it's just a great reflection of England. And I just think it's the direction the character should go in now. I think it's, you know.
So a good Bond needs to be a Bond for our time. So.
Yeah, I think so. Absolutely. I think so. And also, to be honest with you, I mean, I don't really care what Bond looks like. I think it's just a case of getting the right actor in that role. That you know, yeah. I mean, I never saw it, but they're talking about the fella from Bridgerton. A lot of people are talking about him as the next Bond.
Well, it's just open a newspaper and whatever's popular at the moment. They're talking about the guy as the next Bond.
You're right.
Oh, Doctor Who. Oh, yeah. Pinch of salt, I think. When Bond first launched in the 50s in the books, it was very much about a British secret agent traveling the globe. That was carried over into the movies. Roger Moore was a very British Bond. Have we lost some of that Britishness over the character over the last 10 years or so with the Daniel Craig Bonds? Does he feel uniquely British? Does he feel like a British character on cinema now in the same way as Roger Moore did? In the same way as Timothy Dalton did and Sean Connery did?
I'd say Daniel Craig is a very international character, I think. But I think the series is still trying to emphasise its Britishness by way of the supporting characters and the way that they react to the main guy. You know, the characters in the background, be it M, Q, anyone else who's sort of around in the organisation, it's still very sort of old school Thai, very sort of English, very traditional with Bond in the middle of it, almost as a bit of a loose cannon, you know, that they sort of respond to. And I think he's an international character, but the organisation around him and the whole setup, I think there is still this emphasis on Britain. And you've seen that in something like the Kingsman series, which has come along as the latest Bond ripoff, if you like, or series franchise that's been influenced by Bond. And that, I think, really plays on its Englishness. And it does so because Bond does.
Yeah, I would agree with that largely. I think, if you only need to look at something like Skyfall, I felt that felt really English. And having now, I was actually in LA when Skyfall came out. And it's so weird because you do always, or I always think of Bond as something so English. And, you know, being in America and it just being absolutely everywhere, you know, and every billboard, every poster, it was all over. And you think, God, it really does make you realize. I mean, I know it's stupid because, of course, I know that Bond is a massively international franchise, but you know, it was quite almost surprising to see just how big a deal it was in America as well as it is in England.
But I think that Britishness, that old-fashioned Britishness, is still a selling point. I think that sells
very
around
much.
The world.
So.
I'm interested to know why you're asking this question, Adam, because it seems so obvious to me. But I'm sensing you might have a differing
view. No, not at all. Not massively. I mean, it just occurs to me that there's I don't know, less flavour. I mean, maybe it's because of the influence of Bourne and the influence of those movies, that these movies, they don't look British to me. And I don't know whether I need a Union Jack slaps over everything to reinforce it. But I don't know. There's just something that's international about them.
I think they're taking a very positive view of movie Britain, though. I think they're pitching Britain into that world and saying, yeah, in the way the Kingsman films do. I think both series at the moment are sort of saying, yeah, Britain's got a place in the world, and it'll be interesting to see how any future films in both series sort of react to what's happening in Britain today. I think that sense of pride might be sort of, you know, disappearing.
Well, it's an interesting thing you say that about the sense of British and Britain's place in the world, because that's kind of a really reason this whole franchise, this whole book series first started. You know, you've got Britain coming out of the war, a defeated nation in some ways. We won the war, but we were massively in debt to America. The empire was gone. We weren't the power that we were just 20 years ago prior to that. And then suddenly we could still be the huge nation that we thought we were via our characters like Bond. Right.
Going back to the point you just made about Bond not looking English, and I don't mean to put you on the spot, but just to help me understand what you mean by that, what can you give me give me an example of a film that you think does look?
Well, I think maybe I don't know. I mean, the Kingsman films feel English to me. I don't know whether it's in the tone of the writing or it's in the tone of the setting and the juxtaposition of the working class and the high class sort of like together. Sometimes when Bond's not done tippy top well, it feels like it's a depiction of a stereotype of what England is or Britain is, rather than a depiction of what Britain is.
Yeah, well, I think that's fair, and I think it does lean into English stereotype. Yeah, I think that's fair. I've really felt Skyfall particularly felt very English. Yeah. With the London setting,
and arguably but, it's most.
It's interesting to hear what you mean. Yeah, it's interesting to hear. But I do think it does lean somewhat into the stereotype of Englishness to a point. But I think Kingsman takes that stereotype and grabs it by the throat, doesn't it? Kingsman loves that stereotype.
It's a stereotype of upper class Englishness in the Bond films.
Yes.
You know, so very you know, much is, yeah. Yeah. I mean, it evens the point of like, why can't we have a working class Q?
As you've said in Kingsman, we have that representative of the working class who's entering this world and is sort of coerced into this world, but is also almost sort of winking at the audience and saying, I'm here as you in row three who work in a factory, you know, I'm your representative here, and let's all take the piss out of these toffs and these sophisticates.
Well, it definitely needs to be ahead of the time as opposed to be behind the time. It needs to, you know, that's what Bond needs to make sure it does in order to stay relevant, you know?
And it's been at its most successful when it is. I think you can look through the whole series and the good films are the ones that have been sort of forward-looking and forward-thinking, and the bad ones have been the reactive ones, to use your words.
I still love Moonraker, but I know what you mean.
Awful, awful, awful movie. I in preparation for this, I rewatched a lot of the Bond movies, and mainly, and I thought, well, I don't really need to see the Sean Connery ones again. I've seen them so many times. So I started with the Roger Moore ones. We haven't really talked about the Roger Moore ones that much on this podcast, but the Roger Moore ones I find really fascinating in their sort of like continuity. There's not the sort of like hard continuity of things, but you get little things that carry over and link the movies. So you have like, you know, Live and Let Die, and then you have The Man in Golden Gun, you have that the Southern Sheriff, J.W. Pepper. He crosses over into those two movies. And then you get Jaws coming over in the two movies. You know, you get these little things that just like link them softly.
That gives it a sense of a whole world of again in a more jokey way than what is happening with Daniel Craig. This is the Roger Moore Bond's continuing story sort of thing. It's all one.
Yeah,
big
he did seven movies back to back, whereas like Sean Connery, who also did seven, if you include the non-canon one, but he only did five in the run, and I think the last two, Octopussy and A View to a Kill, you're starting to see the sort of like the legs are going, you know, it's not quite, you know, particularly with a casting on A View to a Kill, where you cast Roger Moore in his late 50s, Patrick McNee in his early 60s, and then you've got Christopher Walken and Grace Jones up against him. It's just like, you're just emphasizing the fact that these are old guys now, you know.
They're two awesome villains, though. I love those villains.
But I think they're the only two films out of the 25, 26 that they've done that have a sort of geriatric, a noticeably geriatric Bond in them. You know, I mean, if you look at the ages of the actors, I'm sure others have played Bond. There's only a few years between them. There's never been a very young one or a very old one. So Moore's not. In real terms, he was not noticeably older than anyone else, but he looked older, and you could feel it in the film. And they were on their last legs.
I mean, in a way, it'd be great in the same way that Casino Royale explored. I mean, you know, just when you thought you didn't need another origin story of any, you know, the Bond origin story actually turned out to be really quite, very interesting. I thought it'd be equally interesting to explore a retiring Bond, you know, a Bond having to live with. This guy who's been almost superhuman and, you know, never losing a fight, being able to pull off these incredible feats, but, you know, maybe see him where he doesn't pull off something or he loses a fight.
One idea people have talked about quite a lot in recent years has been to do a 60s set Bond now, you know, make that now.
I don't like the idea of that.
Oh, I do. Why don't you like the idea of that?
I just think it'd be a killer for the franchise. I think Bond is always, for good or ill, it's always modern day, you know. It's always current.
Could you not do it as a standalone? Yeah, you could. A completely different actor.
You could do it as a. I mean, what would be really interesting is similar to what Tarantino was talking about doing with Star Trek. Do it as a sort of like non-canon film, and it's like it's alongside it. I mean, there's more opportunities.
He was talking about doing that with Bond as well, wasn't he? Tarantino. He was talking about doing Casino Royale with Brosnan.
Yeah, they'll never let him touch Bond.
Yeah.
Thank you so much for joining us. Go track down as many Bond films as you can squeeze in before the end of September, and we'll be hopefully unleashing No Time to Die finally on big screens then. We will see you again in a couple of weeks' time. Do check out our Facebook page. Do join our Patreon for additional episodes that we and Daryl and other people have recorded. They're exclusive to that platform for at least 6 months, so you get extra podcasts from us on our Patreon. And we will see you soon. Take care.